All right, as our counsel for the next case are getting settled here, I will announce it. The next case, third case on our calendar this morning, is A230309, In Re Daniel Craig et al. Petitioners. And I think you've been in the courtroom for at least one or two of these arguments. I think you know the rules as well. Please note that because we're making an audio recording of your argument, it would be very helpful to us if you identify yourself and the party you're representing before you begin presenting. We'll begin with appellant. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Chris Morris. I'm from the Bassford Remley Law Firm in Minneapolis, and I'm here representing petitioners who are also defendants, the Eklund and Blando Law Firm, and two of their lawyers individually, Dan Craig, who's a partner at the firm, and Anne St. Amant, who's an associate attorney at the firm. Ms. St. Amant is seated here in the front row of the courtroom. I want to begin by thanking the court for having in-person argument. It's been a long time since I've been in this building, and I think it makes a difference, and I really appreciate it.
We like it, too.
Why am I here? We are seeking to make permanent a writ of prohibition that was previously issued by this court, I think on March 28 of this year, staying a Hennepin County District Court order that compels Eklund and Blando to attorneys to be cross-examined about various matters that they consider privileged or that their client in a separate Dakota County case considers to be privileged. And also questions that would implicate their own opinion work product and mental impressions about what they included in a complaint and what wasn't included, et cetera.
Counsel, can I just frame this a little more, just put some parentheses on it? It seems to me that the only record that we have that establishes the basis for the allegations of privilege or the assertions of privilege is the deposition transcript. We don't have a transcript of the motion to compel hearing, and I didn't see any other affidavits from counsel in the record. So are we limited to what's in that transcript?
I don't think so. Well,
if there's something else, let me know.
There.
In the record.
In the record. It's limited what records we attach to as an addendum and index, right, on this. And first time in 30 years I've ever done a petition for writ of prohibition. So I thought I've seen it all, but this is new to me. There is, in the Hennepin County District Court, which I think this court has access to, I supplied an affidavit or declaration in opposition to the motion to compel. The plaintiffs supplied various deposition transcripts. There were letters written to the court. I would think that those materials would be, I would think that the Hennepin, and by the way, the case is moving on. Of course, we're here interlocutory. There have been filings in the court subsequent to my filing this petition for writ of prohibition.
Is there something in those filings or something in our record that sets forth the basis for the assertion of privilege other than the substance of what's in the deposition transcript?
I think the substance of the deposition transcript is the main thing.
And okay. So when you look at the deposition transcript, and I've looked at these questions very closely.
Yes.
There seem to be a lot of questions that ask, I will put them into buckets. The first bucket is, what's the factual basis for this assertion? What is the basis of a claim of attorney-client privilege when the question is asking what the factual basis of a claim is?
Well, the factual basis, I think that they were inquiring about what the Eklund and Blando law firm learned from its client, Ms. Trimble, right? They're representing Ms. Trimble. There's a complaint. This whole case revolves, this defamation case, revolves around the contents of a complaint in Dakota County. So the source of that material, the exhibits in that complaint, the allegations, the fact allegations in that complaint, the sole source of that is Ms. Trimble. I don't think there's any dispute about that.
Well, I don't think that when, I mean, what isn't there a difference between asking a question of as to what is the source of your information versus what is the factual basis of this assertion?
Well, I think that I objected to questions to the extent that it would require him to reveal client communications, and then he would decline to answer the questions. I don't know what else I could do to describe the verbal communications that he received from Ms. Trimble that would have gone into their decisions about what to include in the complaint, in the Dakota County complaint.
So it's your position that for counsel to answer a question asking for the factual basis of an assertion, that any answer from counsel would reveal confidential client communications?
If that was the only basis, if he had other facts besides what he learned from Ms. Trimble that weren't work product, he could have and would have answered the question.
What's the legal authority to support the proposition that when an attorney learns facts from a client, that those facts are privileged?
I don't think that communications with the client, communications, I would cite to the privilege statute, which I can't recite off the top of my head.
Doesn't the privilege only apply to the communication of legal advice, client seeking legal advice, and the attorney providing legal advice?
Right. So when, for example, Ms. Trimble provided the Eklund and Blando firm with a stack of text messages between her and Mr. Cook, or photographs, evidence, that has been produced, okay? That material has been produced. What we haven't produced or commented on are written or verbal communications from Ms. Trimble to, for example, Ms. St. Amant saying, here is what happened to me.
What's the difference between those two things?
One is pre-existing evidence, facts, evidence, that it doesn't become magically privileged just because you handed it to a lawyer, right? Picture of her injured isn't privileged.
But what happened to her and her description of what happened to her doesn't become magically privileged because she communicated it to a lawyer either. Does it?
Oh, sure. If my client sends me an email describing the incident in two paragraphs, this is my recollection, and here's the underlying contract, and here's my underlying evidence, I would never produce or comment on the email that my client gave me in describing the situation. I would, however, produce the underlying evidence.
So other than the statute, is there some other legal authority that you can cite to me that those kinds of factual communications are privileged?
You know, I'm sure there are cases, Judge, I haven't. That you're focusing on a very elementary question, I agree. And that level of debate hasn't really gone on in the motion. The debate has been over, the reason we should get to it is because you talked about giving a complaint to the Star Tribune, and anything having to do with the media is so far outside a lawyer's duties that's fair game. Or, you made a settlement demand, and that shows that you were in bad faith. So the reason we get to cross-examine the lawyer about why they talked with the client and decided to demand X in negotiation, we ought to get a chance to cross-examine the lawyer about that because it's not ordinarily privileged, but because there's a defamation claim that survived a Rule 12 motion, and they would like to show actual malice because that's part of the elements when you're suing someone for defaming allegedly a public figure.
So is your response to Judge Frisch's question that when it is a communication from a client to a lawyer or vice versa, it is privileged, period?
Yes, yes.
And that is just a sort of fundamental precept of attorney-client.
As long as it's seeking legal advice, and as long as it was maintained as confidential, right? That we didn't already go talk to a third party about everything that Ms. Trimble said.
Can I ask you about another category of questions
sure.
in the deposition? There's a number of questions where counsel asks, "Did you have this communication? Yes or no?" And it's all these questions are concluded with, this is a yes or no question. And they seem to me, when I read them, to be foundational questions as to whether a privilege might apply to the communications. And all of those questions, or a majority of those questions, have an objection to them, that it's privilege. Whether there was a communication between an attorney and client, and the attorney was instructed not to answer. What is the basis of the what is the legal basis for that objection?
Well,
did you give legal advice, yes or no?
I mean, there might be a few questions where one could split hairs and argue around, you know, can you answer yes, but then you have to stop at yes. On the other hand, sometimes by answering a question that yes, we did, we talked about this, that kind of reveals a little bit about what, you know, the subject of that conversation was. So there can be some difficulty in splitting hairs on those kind of questions, but that's not what I'm faced with in this order to compel. The order, as I read the order to compel, as I said, it says, look, because you shared this complaint with the Star Tribune 2 hours before, not after, it was filed in the Dakota County District Court, that basically transforms the complaint into just a waiver of privilege of what you did to prepare that complaint. I think that's I don't think there's any support for that in the law. I think that's to the extent it's kind of justified as a waiver. That's not there's no Ms. Trimble, the client, she owns the privilege, right?
Make it clear that the complaint that was delivered to the Star Tribune is identical to the complaint that was filed.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
There's no difference, not a comma, not a period, not a page
number.
So.
I don't believe so. And I'm sure there's a filing or some, you know, mark at the top. The other thing about this case, I just wanted to, whenever the defamation is the complaint, right? The complaint has a fact section, right? Ms. Trimble's allegations. What I do when I draft a complaint is I endeavor to accurately describe the key material fact allegations of my client. And then I move on to these counts, and that's my business, right? What kind of legal count am I going to come up with based on the facts? So we did not have a situation where Eklund and Blando was appearing, you know, like Rudy Giuliani or something in the media and saying, I believe that this guy, Mr. Cook, is a bad guy. He's full of it, et cetera, et cetera. They didn't do that. What they did, the only thing they did do in terms of kind of asserting their own opinion is, and the timeline is messed up in the lower court's order, but the first report that came out on this matter of any kind is the ESPN report from Adam Schefter, okay? And it's so... I won't get into this because my time is waning, but the whole strategy was for naught. The whole strategy of having a balanced Star Tribune story to kick off the public, you know, mess, where both sides' attorneys got a voice in it, that did happen, but that wasn't until after ESPN put out a story that was just, you know, labeled, just dumped all over Ms. Trimble, you know, Dalvin Cook's the victim, he's been extorted, et cetera, et cetera.
Can I just ask one procedural question in the remaining time? We're faced with a writ of prohibition. Either the order is enforceable as is, or it is not enforceable as is. Is there some room for us to affirm the order in part, or grant the writ in part, or if the part, or is it just an all or nothing proposition?
A good question. I think that the writ is granted or not. This court always has the ability to include comments surrounding on a remand or what, you know, it's not a remand, but the court always has the ability to include comments about its views on some things that have happened in the record.
Can you tell me when your discovery deadline is?
So we are, because the writ was preliminarily granted, the trial had been scheduled for July. So by stipulation, we kicked the trial back till May. I think we agreed that discovery would end in January of 2024. And this would be, you know, there might be some expert discovery going on, but this would be the main thing here about, there's also, I should mention, there's also a separate proceeding in New York, the sports agent. We subpoenaed the sports agent to produce his communications with Cook. He objected. We got the subpoena enforced. He didn't comply with the order. There's now an order to show cause in New York, and we'll see if that phone ever gets produced. So there are other things going on. This Trimble case, that's set for trial in March of next year.
Okay. That was my next question. Thank you.
Yeah. I'm out of time, so maybe I'll have another comment.
You are out of time, but you will get 5 minutes to speak with us on rebuttal. Thank you, Mr. Morris.
Members of the court, my name is Robert Kina, and I know that the record indicates that my partner, Terry Moore, would have been appearing. We filed the letter and notice of appearance yesterday so that I could appear due to a serious medical emergency, and we did not wish to delay this matter.
Sorry to hear that. Thank you.
Thank you. I would say he's well enough that he kept then speculating if he should pull himself together and show up, but it wasn't worthwhile. Believe me. I appreciate the court's opportunity to hear these issues because really there are essential questions that can just be answered, and they're easily answered in this circumstance. One question is was there an abuse of discretion? So we examine the court's order.
I think that before we even get to the question of whether the court abused its discretion, we have to answer the question of whether the court misapplied the law. And I want to ask some questions about the waiver portion of the court's order. I mean, I've never seen a case that has concluded, anywhere in the country, that has concluded that the delivery of a complaint to a third party before its filing operates as a waiver of the attorney-client privilege or the work product doctrine. Is there some case that stands for that proposition in any jurisdiction?
I haven't seen a case with similar facts, and I also did look, but it... Your point makes a good point. And counsel has argued within his brief that if this is allowed, this will be a constant repeated event because essentially must be similar cases like this where this would open up the floodgates on this argument. But really, this is a rare circumstance. And this is a rare circumstance because what we know and what has been pressed away is that a lawsuit does not commence until it is served.
But is it rare? I mean... you know, having represented a public entity for more than a decade, it was not uncommon for information about a potential lawsuit to be disclosed to the press ahead of the actual filing or service of the lawsuit. I mean, it happens all the time.
It does happen.
And has any court found that those communications... operate as a waiver of the privilege or a work product?
I don't see anywhere where that issue came up because I believe that in those circumstances, there was never a finding that the complaint was defamatory.
Okay, so let me ask this in a different way. A complaint is not a confidential document. So you'd agree with that, right? I mean, it's filed.
Very rarely what I imagine it ever would be.
So if the complaint is disclosed to a third party, what about that would reveal an attorney's mental impressions inadvertently, that which are confidential, or a confidential communication between a lawyer and client about the dispensing or request of legal advice?
Well, your question does go to the portion of the order which relates to waiver.
Yes.
And the judge also cited the rule of professional responsibility with regard to when it can be waived. And that rule gave specific examples of when this waiver can occur under the rules. Well, I don't know that a complaint typically involves necessary confidential mental impressions. I've been involved as a litigator for 28 years. But what happens when someone does something, they are sued for it, the plaintiff survives Rule 11, and one of the central elements were, what were you thinking? What did you know when you commenced this or when you published this defamatory document? Now, we may get caught up in the fact that it was a complaint which was served days later, but the fact of the matter is what this simply is a defamatory document which was published.
I mean, what I'm hearing from you is that the information is relevant, but attorney-client communications or an attorney's mental impressions would always be relevant.
That's correct. Now, there's distinctions, and the court did an excellent job of making the distinctions. And the distinctions are, what about facts? Because there's a difference between legal advice and facts. And if you, as the court properly pointed out moments ago when they were discussing those questions, what if you cannot get the facts which form the basis for a complaint as part of your discovery? Imagine that circumstance whereby every plaintiff would simply download all facts that they have into their complaint, claim that they received them from their client, and therefore you are no longer to do discovery with regard to those facts. Although I may seem like I'm exaggerating here, I'm not. That's essentially what they're saying, and that's why the court made the distinction and why we made the distinction in our brief between facts worth versus legal advice.
Now, so, you'd agree, though, that that is a separate question from waiver, right?
I do.
Okay.
Yeah.
So just back to the issue of waiver, I just want to close that off before we get to sort of the substance of the objections. What is the thing that caused the waiver here? Is it just the delivery of the complaint? And then if so, what about that operated as a waiver?
There's a couple of different things. Not only was there the delivery of the complaint and the defamatory information in it, there was also a meeting with the Star and Tribune in front with his client with him. And we all recall from law school the elevator rule. What happens if you and your client have an otherwise privileged conversation on an elevator and there's a third party standing there? We know that it can result in a waiver of privilege.
Now, I think that they answered the questions about what happened in that meeting, though, right?
Well, I think they made arguments with regard to what occurred, but that didn't address the deeper questions, which were, what were the facts that you had on these topics?
Okay, so let's just put a pin in that for one moment. In the deposition, when asked about the meeting, specifically about what transpired during that meeting, the attorney answered the question.
I agree with you.
Okay.
But understand, if simply because you say, here's what was said on the elevator in front of the third party, it doesn't mean that a waiver of privilege would be limited to just the conversation on the elevator. That's not that waiver rule. There have been arguments that a waiver of privilege is a waiver of privilege. And in this circumstance, we do have a different issue. We have an issue of not simply one party saying, hey, I'm litigating against your client and I want to know all the communications between you and your client so that I can use them in my case. This is a lawsuit against an attorney for a separate and distinct tort. And the separate and distinct tort includes knowledge. And therefore, questions regarding how did you know that? I mean, simple questions like, before you prepared this defamatory complaint, and I will say this, I expect the court had an opportunity to read petitioner's statement of the facts, which, frankly, having been thrown into this case later because of my partner's illness, I read it with, not unlike you did, I read his facts and then I read our facts. And you can see that there is a broad distinction between the two recitation of facts as to what occurred here.
So just, if we could just talk about sort of what you're getting at or what you hope to get at with this information. Are you hoping that, would it be ideal for your case to get some communications between attorney and client about how the client made it all up and the attorney knew that it was all false, but filed the complaint nonetheless. Is that the kind of material that you're thinking will surface here potentially?
How did you come to know what you alleged in this defamatory document? Did you contact the other people that were in the room at that time? Or was this exclusively from your client?
But isn't that material that goes just right to the heart of attorney-client privilege and attorney work product? I mean, right at the heart of it.
I think it doesn't, and here's why. There's a difference between facts and legal advice. If we were asking this attorney to say, tell us what you told her in terms of her potential for claims on defamation. Tell us what you told her with regard to her potential claims of slander or...
So you want us to look at facts and legal advice as two things that exist in a vacuum.
Well, what the law says on this talk, and I will never pronounce this name correctly, the Kobluk case.
That's correct.
Is it?
Yes.
Under the Kobluk case, they do actually examine that distinction. They don't make it so starkly as, hey, by the way, that's a fact, that's not privilege, that's not. But when there are underlying facts in this circumstance, you have to go to outside jurisdictions to get out of this. And the fact of the matter is, I'll go back to that point I was making earlier. Imagine if every fact my client gives to me, I put in my answer. And then when they ask me for discovery on my damages, I say, sorry, there's no documents on it. I think to myself, I only have what she told me. With regard to my decision to draft this, what we maintain is riddled with falsities, document, we need to know. Did you get it from your client or did you just make this up? What is the basis for it? Because this is a public figure. This is a person who is absolutely well known. There's been headlines about this case. And the question then becomes, what is actual malice? Did you recklessly disregard the truth? And using the privilege as a shield with regard to the facts that you knew is different than if we sat in front of that attorney and said, tell me what legal advice you gave her. Tell me what you...
You did ask that question.
Well, and he objected to it, but the court's order, if you'll recall, is different. What we're on here today is with regard to the writ of prohibition related to the court's order, and what the court did is it broke it down into three separate categories. It broke it down with regard to a work product, not a privilege issue, with regard to the preparation of this media campaign.
Can I just, with your remaining time, I want to ask you some questions about the media advice or potential hybrid of legal and media advice or how that all works together. And it's not clear to me from your briefing whether you're asking for a new bright line rule with respect to the application of the attorney-client privilege when that may intersect with communications with the media, or whether, for example, the rule that's set forth in Kobluk might be sufficient to assess those communications individually to determine whether they fall into traditionally privileged communications.
Well,
And if you're asking for a new rule, I want to know what the rule is that you're asking for.
Actually, we're not asking for anything. We're the respondents, and we're asking that the order be upheld. But if you're asking what would be the consequence of that, of upholding that rule, I think it is, as the district court judge said, this is a fact-specific case. The judge specifically said he was not ruling on admissibility, was specifically said that, pointed out that in this circumstance, under these facts, that is the circumstance. But the...
But Mr. Keenan, you conceded earlier that this happens with some regularity. So what in terms of publishing of a complaint and or contacting the media, and so we presume that's all part of discussions with the client. So what was specific that makes this unique?
Well, number one, it was defamatory and included completely false statements, and I don't know that I've ever seen a defamatory complaint, setting aside the litigation privilege, a complaint that sat on its own as defamatory.
Well, who cares that it was disclosed to the media? I mean, it sounds like your argument is just that you get at the false information just by the filing of the complaint itself.
Except that this was published, and I'm a lawyer. I'm a strict guy on the rules, and what I know is that if you make these allegations in a served, not filed, served complaint, then you're subject to a privilege, a defamation privilege. But if you do it the way this attorney did, and you literally include facts which the actual witnesses to the event say never occurred, were directly the opposite as to what occurred, before you do that, as most lawyers would, and that is why we have not seen many cases like this, they are going to check out the facts. They are not going to do that without more care. And in this circumstance, it is knowledge of falsity or reckless disregard of falsity. And
in any time there is an action like this, are you saying that the attorney's investigatory efforts become discoverable?
Well, I don't know that there ever should be another case like this, but I think that the attorney's investigatory efforts would, under this circumstance where there's a defamation case related to a public official, regarding malice, I think the investigatory efforts may be discoverable. Yes, I do think that.
And under, okay. All right, thank you.
There was a great deal I was going to say, but I believe I'm out of time.
It goes quickly.
But it does, certainly does.
Well, we thank you for your argument.
Thank you very much.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honors. Just briefly, I'll just make a couple of reaction comments. So it's interesting to hear about, I agree this is a unique case. This is a crazy case. I've never had anything like it in my life and hope to never see one again. But when you look at the Minnesota privilege law, case law, statute, when it says attorney-client, communications that are confidential privilege, there's no exception for it. But if you get sued on a defamation claim, doors wide open. There's no exception for that. It sounds to me like the argument, so all lawyers will take whatever your ruling is here and apply it to the next situation. It seems to me that the next time I get a case that I want to depose the plaintiff's counsel on, what I ought to do, if I don't want to sue him for defamation, I ought to make a Rule 11 motion and say, your facts are sanctionable. There's no good faith basis. And the first thing I want to do is to depose plaintiff's lawyer. I'll subpoena the plaintiff's lawyer, and I'll say, well, this is all relevant, Your Honor, because I've asserted a sanctions motion, and I need to get at his attorney-client communications in order to prove my case. Why wouldn't that apply in the same way as what we're seeing right here? I do think the court would be opening the barn door to this kind of tactic, and it is a tactic. This case, I hear a lot of hyperbole about how bad the facts are. Read the text messages between Delvin Cook and Grace Trimble, and tell me that the only fair interpretation is not that he's admitting some form of guilt. The evidence attached to the complaint is overwhelming. We now have evidence that's been ongoing that in which the sports agent is directing lawyers to bring this action in order to create leverage, create conflicts, disqualify Eklund and Blandall. That's was the point. Helmuth and Johnson wasn't involved back then. There's been a whole run of lawyers on the other side. But that was the point from the get-go. Now it's being used as a potential way to prejudice Ms. Trimble, whose trial is set for early next year. And I think it's unfair and would be a horrible public policy result. A couple other things. There's mention of Rule 1.6, the ethics rule. I deal with that all the time. We represent lawyers in malpractice cases and who gets sued. And that is a way that you can talk about a client confidence without violating your ethical duties. Because there's an ethical duty normally, you can't not only divulge a privileged communication, it's pretty broad. You can't talk about a client matter with third parties if it's not authorized. Well, that's all well and good, but Rule 1.6 does not trump privilege. Rule 1.6 does not allow Eklund and Blando to say, if they wanted to in this case, you know what? We could defend this defamation case maybe a little better by revealing some privileged information because it would help not hurt. They can't do that. Why? Because they have a client named Ms. Trimble who's separately represented, who's instructed me to protect her privilege, and it's her privilege to protect. So Rule 1.6 does not help us out and is not should not be part of the analysis. In terms of discovery on what's your settlement demand or we should get at the facts, Ms. Trimble was deposed for a full day. That they discover medical records. There's full damages discovery in that Dakota County case. They're not prohibited from asking her whatever they want about her damages, about what happened, et cetera. What they can't get at is what were the dealings between the client and the lawyer when they came up with this complaint and their litigation strategy? That's improper. There was some discussion about the meeting. Yes, that was fully disclosed. What happened at the meeting? There was no privileged material being given to the reporter then. That would be a waiver if Ms. Trimble said, "Hey, reporter, I had protected all these emails or conversations that I had with my lawyer about the complaint, but I'm going to disclose those to you. Here they are. Here's all the material that we had held as confidential before." That didn't happen. The only thing given to the reporter was the complaint, and we've already covered that quite a bit. So with that, I think that I will simply ask that the court enter a final order confirming the writ of prohibition and upholding Ms. Trimble's privilege. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you both for your arguments this morning. The case is now submitted to the court, and we will issue our decision within the statutory time frame.